Playing in the background is the London Symphony Orchestra with The Black Hole. There is a reason why we're playing this instead of Vangelis. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and I'm flying solo this evening. On this week's The Space Show, Black Holes and Gravitational Waves, we visit Monash University and chat with Professor Eric Thrain. Well, forget what you learned in that movie, Black Hole. The reality is quite different. And we're going to start with Black Hole Disco by the Physics Chanteurs. Now, this was written in honour of physicist Kip Thorne. And the chirping sound is the synthesized sound of two colliding black holes causing gravitational waves. And we'll hear those from Eric when we get down to our chat. So let's see if we can get this going now.
Gravity waves penetrate my brain. Black hole.
Pretty much everyone has heard of black holes, but not many people fully understand them. So I popped out to Monash University, to the School of Physics and Astronomy, and chatted with Professor Eric Thrain about that very topic. So we're going to discuss black holes, gravitational waves, how to detect them, and how black holes can join together. Yes. Black holes eat black holes. So let's go to Monash University. Welcome to the Space Show, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you tell us a bit about a black hole? What is it?
A black hole is an object in astronomy that we believe forms from the collapse of a massive star. When a really big star has burned all of its nuclear fuel, it can no longer keep itself puffed up. And so it collapses under the influence of its own gravity until it forms what I like to think of as a tear in the fabric of space-time. And this tear is an extreme curvature in the shape of space-time, which means that not even light can escape from this tear. And that's why black holes are called black. Their main property that we know about them is that even if you try to shine a light from a torch as you fall into a black hole, that light will never escape from the black hole.
And of course, the name black hole was pejorative.
Black holes have come a long way since they were first theorized many, many decades ago, but now they're really a part of mainstream science. We know about black holes in our own Milky Way galaxy that we can see mass accreting onto them using X-rays and light. And we know about them as well from other studies, including gravitational waves, which is what I'm here to talk to you about today.
How do they form?
There are a couple of ways that we know black holes can form. One is from the collapse of massive stars. After the star has exhausted its nuclear fuel, it can collapse in on itself to form a black hole. But we also believe that black holes can form from other black holes. So if you have two small black holes and they run into each other, they'll merge, and that will make a heavier black hole. And we think that both of these ways of forming black holes are at work in the universe in order to explain the black holes we see today.
So how does this merger give rise to gravitational waves? And what is a gravitational wave anyway?
Great question. So black holes and gravitational waves are both predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity. And Einstein's theory tells us we should picture space-time as like a stretchy sheet of fabric. And a massive object is like a ball that you put on the stretchy sheet of fabric, and it causes that fabric to sag. Now, I've already told you that black holes are like a rip in the fabric of space-time. But if you have two of these rips going around each other, they cause ripples to form on this fabric sheet, kind of like if you toss a pebble into a pond, it will cause ripples to spread out from the point of impact. But when two black holes go around each other faster and faster, this causes ripples in the fabric of space-time. And these ripples are what we call gravitational waves. We believe that gravitational waves are passing through us right now as we're doing this interview and as your listeners are hearing us. And if you could feel them, they're so weak you can't feel them, but if you could, you would feel yourself momentarily being stretched, made slightly taller and slightly thinner, and the next minute being squished down, made slightly shorter and slightly wider. Back and forth, taller, shorter. And so this is the signature of gravitational waves passing through us here on Earth, but it's an extremely faint signal, and so we need to build very sophisticated machines in order to detect this gravitational wave on Earth.
In fact, one of the original gravitational wave detecting attempts was, in fact, to measure the changing length in a bar of, I forget what metal it was.
Is that? Niobium.
Niobium.
Yes. So in the 60s, pioneering work by Joseph Weber and some other scientists, including scientists in Australia, David Blair, David McClelland, making bar detectors. And these were just giant pieces of metal. And the hope was that if a gravitational wave hit them just right, they would ring in the same way that a tuning fork rings when you strike a tuning fork. But these tuning forks were huge. They were as big as a, you know, bigger than a human, you know, like the size of a car. And it turns out that these early bar detectors weren't sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves. We now know that with the benefit of hindsight. And so other machines using lasers had to be created in order to actually detect gravitational waves.
Now, take the black holes that come from stars, collapsing stars. Isn't there a maximum size that a star can be, and therefore that would put a limit on how big a black hole could be?
Well, stars can get awfully large, we think, but we do think there are some restrictions on the kind of black holes they can leave behind. And that's because of the way stars explode. So in general, if you want to make a black hole, you need a fairly large star. Our own sun will never make a black hole. It's too small. So you need to put a lot of matter into one place. And then eventually, the star becomes big enough, you can make a black hole. But if you want to make a bigger black hole, you add more matter, right? So you have bigger star, bigger black hole. But that only works up to a point. Because at some point, the center of the star burns so hot that something special happens inside the star. And it causes an explosion that disrupts the entire star, leaving behind nothing. No black hole, nothing. Just an explosion. And so astrophysicists believe that there ought to be some cutoff in the mass of black holes. You can eventually make even bigger black holes by combining, you know, having two black holes merged together, or if you have a really, really big star, eventually it will collapse. But there should be some window where you can't make them, because not from a star at any rate, because the star ought to just explode. But the problem is that we are seeing black holes in this region where it's difficult to explain how they would be made from stars. And so that's been a very exciting development in astronomy, is understanding where these black holes, about 70, 80 times the mass of our sun, where are they coming from?
So you're having to put your thinking cap on and come up with some new ideas.
Absolutely. And this is one of the exciting things about astronomy and science in general, is that you make predictions, you test your predictions, and you often find mysteries. And these mysteries have to be explained. We don't know the answers in advance. And sometimes some of our models that we have need to be tweaked or changed. In the case of these 80 solar mass black holes, we had an idea ready to explain these. And this was this idea of making black holes from smaller black holes. So even though an 80 solar mass black hole can't be made directly from a star, we think, if we can make 240 solar mass black holes, and those black holes can bump into each other, they can make an 80 solar mass black hole. And we think that that might be the way that these 80 solar mass black holes are created.
Now, onto your discovery recently, a gravitational wave in 2023. What happened there?
So in the last month and a bit, my collaboration, the LIGO collaboration, which stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, announced a new and exciting discovery. And this was the detection of the most massive black hole binary we'd seen yet. This one tipped the scales with two black holes each more than 100 times more massive than our own sun. And this one is particularly weird and hard to explain. If you ask me how it was formed, my honest answer is I don't know. I've seen a couple of interesting papers that have come out just in the last 2 weeks offering some speculations on where this thing may have formed, but I'm still digesting them, and I don't have an opinion yet. I will tell your listeners that there's another very peculiar thing about these black holes that we observed in 2023, and that is that they're spinning really fast. So black holes, it turns out, have just two properties, mass and spin, and these two properties determine everything there is to determine about the black hole. And the spin can leave an imprint on these ripples in the fabric of space-time that we measure with LIGO. So we can measure how fast if they're spinning. And this particular pair of black holes seem to be spinning maybe close to the limit allowed, the maximum speed limit allowed by Einstein's theory of general relativity. And that's also very strange, because not only is it hard to understand how such massive black holes formed, it's also hard to understand what would have spun them up so quickly. So some of the theoretical speculation that I've been reading in the last couple of weeks is also trying to understand not just how these black holes got to be so massive, but also potentially how they got to be spinning so rapidly.
it's not surprising that they'd spin because they're formed from a star which is rotating. Conservation of angular momentum means that as they shrink, they would spin faster.
It's complicated, though, because there is a branch of stellar astrophysics, the study of stars, that looks at this question. And until recently, and arguably to this day, a lot of people in the community think that the spin in a star before it blows up is in the outer shells of the star. And so the black hole, on the other hand, gets formed from the stellar core. And so some people, a lot of people in the community, think that the black holes ought to be born spinning pretty slowly because the spinning bit of the star gets blown off in the supernova explosion that creates the black holes. So maybe that theory is wrong. This is one of the things people are debating. Or if you have two black holes and they merge and they create another new black hole and that goes on to merge again, that is one mechanism that can cause the black hole to spin up, because the black holes formed through mergers, that we know that those are spinning pretty fast, but still not as fast as this 2023 discovery. So even that explanation a little bit struggles to explain the data. It's quite a bizarre measurement.
Is it possible that two spinning black holes spinning in opposite directions, when they merge, the spin would cancel?
I'm gathering my thoughts here. It would be very hard to concoct that. The reason is that most of the spin that the remnant black hole gets does not come from the spin of the parents, but from the orbit of the two black holes going around each other. So even if the black hole parents that are going to give rise to this bigger black hole baby, even if they're not spinning at all, they're going around each other very fast. And that's the thing that really makes their baby spin quickly. So you would have to contrive it so they were both spinning opposite to the direction of the way they were going around each other, if that makes sense. And this would require some fine tuning. So I think that's probably hard.
The space show is at Monash University, the School of Physics and Astronomy. And we're chatting with Professor Eric Threin, and we've got a lot more to talk about as the space show progresses through the evening. And we're going to just go back to Linda Williams. In 2004, she recorded the black hole gravity wave chirp song. And this is a parody written to honour Kip Thorne. And the chirps are acoustic representations of gravity waves produced by two colliding black holes. And I point out that such gravity waves were first detected in 2016. So let's see if we can get it going.
Black hole spinning in the dead of night. Silent night, dancing around, space-time torques and tides, until you collide. We are waiting for your song to arrive. Black holes collide, black holes collide. Into the night, little black holes collide. Black hole spinning in the dead of night, spiraling around out of sight, until you collide. We are waiting for your waves to arrive. Black holes collide, black holes collide. Black holes sing in the dead of night, spiraling around out of sight until you collide. We are waiting for your song to arrive. We are waiting for your waves to arrive. Whoop, 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 whoop,
whoop, whoop. This is The Space Show.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to The Space Show. On Monday, I popped out to Monash University and the School of Physics and Astronomy and had a chat with Professor Eric Thrain about, well, his favourite topic, I'm sure, and you've heard some of it already. So now let's go on and discuss binaries. Now, binaries is where you get two stars orbiting each other. If you saw the movie Star Wars, the original Star Wars, and you saw Luke Skywalker on Tatooine, and you saw those two suns in the sky, that's what a binary is. And it turns out that both of those two stars could turn into a black hole, and those two black holes could collide. So let's hear from Professor Thrain about this event. A large number of stars are binaries. They're two stars orbiting each other. And isn't it surprising that two black holes in space that be unlikely to meet? So these mergers are coming from what were originally binary stars.
So your first point that many, many stars are in binaries is a really useful one for the audience to know. In some ways, we have a twisted view of reality here on Earth because our sun is a little bit of an oddball being an isolated star. But as to black holes wandering into each other on accident, we think that this can happen in special places in the universe. And in particular, globular clusters, you can visualize these as like clouds of stars that are all gravitationally bound to each other. But if you look at a picture of one, they kind of look like a cloud. And so they're, this puffy ball of stars. And what happens in these clusters is that the heavy stuff tends to sink to the bottom of the cluster, to the middle of the cluster, and the light stuff gets flung out. This is something that happens in gravitationally bound systems. And because of that, the black holes are the heaviest stuff. So they preferentially sink into the center of these clusters where they are prone to find each other. And then they can form binaries, even if they weren't originally in a binary, they will form binaries with each other. And then those black holes, once they're in a binary, they get driven closer and closer together, because if you have two black holes in a binary, they're going around each other, and now a third object bumps into them, most likely what will happen is that third object will get flung out very fast. But then that means that the two black holes have to get pushed closer together for that to happen. This is like the slingshot effect that we use to send our probes into space, that same thing that NASA uses. But it takes energy, it steals energy away, and it pushes these black holes closer together. So that the black holes get driven closer together through these processes in clusters. We think this is all, there's a lot of indirect evidence, but these are all theoretical ideas that we're trying to test.
When you detect a black hole with the LIGO and Kaguya and forget the name of the other one.
Virgo is the third Virgo. One.
They're a long way away. So can you tell whether they're in a globular cluster or are they just generally in a galaxy, or are they at the core of a galaxy where there's usually a supermassive black hole there anyway?
We can almost never tell precisely where a gravitational wave signal came from. There is one case in all of the hundreds of gravitational wave signals we've seen, which happened in 2017, where we were able to pinpoint the precise location of that gravitational wave. That was the first gravitational waves from a binary neutron star. And the reason we could pinpoint its location is because it gave off a flash of light as well. And light can be localized very precisely, so we cannot just see which galaxy the signal came from, but where in the galaxy it came from. If we only have the gravitational waves, though, we're in a much worse position. We use basically a form of triangulation. So we have there's two LIGO detectors, and then we have a European partner, Virgo, and Japanese partner, Kagra. So 3-4 detectors. And we use the time delay between the detectors to try to pinpoint where on the sky the gravitational wave signal came from and how far away it was. But this is extremely crude estimation compared to the electromagnetic astronomers, the astronomers that use light. And so we don't even know what galaxy other signals came from, let alone whether it was in a globular cluster orbiting some galaxy. And so all of our arguments about where these binaries formed and whether it was in a cluster, these are all involving indirect evidence and theoretical models. And we have admittedly a lot of uncertainty as well. So this is, to a degree, speculation right now, trying to take all the things we can measure, the masses of the black holes, the spins, and put that together into a self-consistent theory.
One of the interesting things I note about your paper on the 2023 event was the signal you detected was only a tenth of a second long. How can you tell out so much from such a short or brief signal?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The more massive a binary black hole is, the shorter the signal it creates in LIGO. And so this particular event, the 2023 event, because it's the most massive, as you correctly point out, it's the shortest signal that we've seen. And it means that there are only a few wiggles. The fabric of space-time was wiggled back and forth just a couple times. And so we compare those wiggles with predictions from Einstein's theory of general relativity, and we use that to determine what the masses were, whether they were spinning. But I will grant you that with so few wiggles, your inferences, your guess as to what the masses and spins of those black holes are more prone to errors than if you have a lot of wiggles. And so I would not be shocked if we end up revising some of our statements, probably not about the mass, but maybe the spins. I think that those are potentially susceptible to what we call systematic errors, where if you, for example, you don't understand the noise in your detector perfectly, you might mistake some of the ways that the signal's wiggling were actually maybe due to noise rather than the signal itself. So I think that's something to stay tuned and watch and see how that develops. I do think the masses are reliable because we can measure the length of the signal, and it was short. And just based on how short it was, we know this thing had to be incredibly heavy.
And we'll hear more from Eric Thrain in a few minutes, but let's go back to Linda Williams and the Freaky Wave Song.
Ocean wave, sound wave, light wave, shock wave, radio wave, microwave, heat wave, brain wave. A wave is a wiggle in space and time. Like an ocean wave, it moves up and down, repeating in cycles of up and down. The up is called the crest, and the trough is the down. The wavelength is the distance from crest to crest or trough to trough. Into a puddle, raindrops drop, and water waves roll off.
A wave carries energy as it goes. Sound waves make air molecules rock and roll. To and fro, from speaker to ear, that's how they go. Sound waves make air molecules rock and roll. The frequency is the rate that sound waves make air molecules shake. The higher the freak, the higher the pitch, and the faster the molecules twitch. The bigger the bell, the longer the wavelength, and the slower the air shakes. The smaller the bell, the shorter the wavelength. that shakes. Tune into my frequency and do the freaky wave with me. Sound waves make me rock and roll, up and down and to and fro. My waves cook your casserole, making water molecules rock and roll. Wave it up, heat it up, eat it up. Physics, yum yum.
And on the space show, we're talking about gravitational waves, which are quite something else again. So let's go back to Eric, and we're going to talk about eccentric orbits. Now, when you say someone's eccentric, you mean they're a bit odd. Well, and when an astronomer talks eccentric, they're talking about something that's not circular. So if you've got an elliptical orbit, that's eccentric. So let's hear it from Eric. When you picture two stars orbiting each other, two black holes orbiting each other, you think of them in circular orbits, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, one of the interesting topics in gravitational wave astronomy is the question of whether black hole orbits are circular or eccentric. And if you want to picture an eccentric orbit in your mind's eye, picture an ellipse. So take a circle and squish it into some non-circular shape. We know that, just around the Earth, things like comets have these highly eccentric trajectories. And while the Earth is an example of a very nearly circular orbit, it turns out that black holes may orbit each other on eccentric orbits if they meet each other in a cluster. So we were talking about these globular clusters a moment ago. If two black holes wander into each other and meet in this environment, this dense stellar environment, they need not form a circular shape. Basically, the randomness with which they meet and they interact can cause them to form something much more eccentric. And that can cause the gravitational wave signal to look quite different. So a normal gravitational wave signal from a circular binary produces a chirping sound. We say a chirping sound because the frequencies of the gravitational wave signal are the same frequencies that the human ear hears. So you can take the data that we collect with LIGO that measures the stretching of the fabric of space-time and convert it to an audio file, and you can play it and you can listen to a gravitational wave signal, and they sound like a chirp. It goes from low to high. Can I do an example for you? Yes. So they go whoop. But if the signal is eccentric, then it's less chirpy, and potentially it can have these stuttering sounds to it from the black hole whipping past the other black hole in a kind of irregular way. It can be more of a whoop, 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 where these, each time there's that sound, it's the passage of closest approach between one black hole to another. And this is really hard to measure. We've tried to measure this. There are some tentative signs that some black hole systems are eccentric, but it, for various mathematical reasons, it's very hard to be sure. So we think we see this, but we can't say for sure.
Eric, now we're going to hear a poem. Ode to a Black Hole was written by John U. Bell.
Though you're just a big black hole in the fabric of space and time, and people say you've got a dark side, but who doesn't? That's not a crime. In all of outer space, it seems there's nothing quite so sublime as a big black hole in the galaxy, and baby, you're all mine. My folks say I can't see you because you're degenerate, but I just tell them you're singular, and that we've never met, for if I get too close to you, it'd be all over for me, forever in your clutches, I'd be caught by your gravity. Chandra Sekhar warned me, Schwarzschild he did too. Hawking and Penrose have had their say, but Albert Einstein, where are you? How can we ever see eye to eye when I can't see you anymore? You'll disappear one day, I fear, sneaking out through a wormhole door whenever I get near you. Time seems to stand quite still, though I make light of the situation. I think I've had my fill. You're too intense for your own good. It's a negative energy, but I'm caught in your massive clutches, at maximum density. Yonder's the event horizon, out here on the cosmic sea. My situation is heavy, looks like it's all X-rays for me.
Eric, the gravitational wave detectors have only been operating and detecting waves since 2015 and have often been up offline for much of that time for upgrades and whatever. So how likely is it that what you've detected is just a freak that's so rare and you were just lucky to get it, or is it fairly common?
I will bet money with anyone who wants to take this bet that what we've seen is pretty typical, and here's my argument why. LIGO, our observatory, only sees a tiny fraction of the universe. So we've seen about 200 gravitational wave signals, but we know that every 3 minutes, somewhere in the universe, on average, two black holes merge. So the vast majority of these gravitational wave signals were missing because our detector is not yet sensitive enough. Every year, we make it more and more sensitive so that we can see further and further away. And eventually, maybe by the 2040s, I predict we'll be able to see the black holes merging in the entire visible universe. But for the time being, we're just getting this very minuscule measurement of what's out there. And so for every one black hole we see, we know that there are many, many others out there. And so it's, from a statistical argument, highly improbable that we would have seen anything unique or rare. Instead, we are just seeing things that are examples from this much larger population. And in all likelihood, the weirdest things we've seen yet are nowhere near as weird as the actual weird things in the universe. So if you ask, you know, what is the most massive black hole merger to take place in the entire universe in the last 100 years, that it would surely be much larger than anything we've seen. And you can make the same argument with other things, spin, for example. So we know that when things appear weird, they're weird to us because of our failure of imagination as scientists to be prepared for what we could have seen. The weirdness is saying as much as it does about our theories as it does about the universe. What the universe considers weird, if you will, is an entirely another matter.
Do you see supernova stars, you know, stars when they explode, do they set off gravitational waves?
They probably do, but supernovae are a much less effective source of gravitational waves than a black hole merger. So a supernova would almost certainly have to take place in our own galaxy in order for us to be able to detect it with LIGO, whereas we can see binary black hole mergers very, very far away in other distant galaxies. Unfortunately, the rate at which supernova go off in our Milky Way is about once per century. So at any moment, one could go off, and it wouldn't be shocking. Things, you have once per century storms sometimes. Once per century stuff happens, but any given year, if you had to bet, you would say probably not this year. So that will be a very exciting discovery when it eventually does happen. We can learn a lot about how stars explode by seeing the gravitational wave signal. And we'll see it before we see the light, because the light takes quite a while to get out of the exploding star and reach us. So we'll see this gravitational waves first, but who knows when.
So let's have a poem now from Patrick Lewis. And of course, the topic is black holes.
A Black Hole by J. Patrick Lewis. A star that's just too fat to hang far out in space may pop and bang. Its insides get so blazing hot, one day it's there, the next it's not. And no one knows exactly why, but in the ceiling of the sky, the hole that swallows starry light as big as day and black as night.
And on the space show, we are in discussion with Eric Thrain from Monash University about, well, you guessed it, black holes and gravitational waves. Let's finish our conversation with a bit more about this. And where do you see your research going from here on?
So we are getting close now to LIGO reaching its design sensitivity. It's still not there yet, but as I mentioned earlier, every year we make it better, trying to get it close to the full specs that it was designed for. It's an incredibly complicated instrument that requires the labor of over 1,000 people from a decade plus in order to build and maintain this machine. But as it stretches further and further, we're detecting these more and more unusual cases. And I think we're starting to get a picture now of what the population of black holes looks like. So in the next 5 years or so, I think what we might realistically be able to do is to start to have some plausible understanding of where these black holes are forming binaries, how they form, how these black holes are related to stellar collapse, and start to shed some light on those mysteries. But looking further into the future, the next generation of gravitational wave detectors after LIGO will truly transform things.
Interstage left, Lisa?
Sorry?
Interstage left, Lisa?
Ah, well, LISA is an interesting example as well, but there are also successor experiments for LIGO. So let me tell you about that, and then I can comment on LISA. So LIGO, the current generation, people are working on replacing that with, years from now, maybe in the 2030s, 2040s, with something called Cosmic Explorer or the Einstein Telescope. And they take the basic design of LIGO, which involves sending a laser beam down 2 4-kilometer-long arms, and they scale it up. They make the laser more powerful. They make the arms 40 kilometers long or 10 kilometers long instead of 4 kilometers long. And they do these various tricks in order to improve the sensitivity. And those instruments, which are set to potentially come online in the 2030s and 2040s, will be able to see every binary black hole in the entire universe. And we in Australia are working to be a part of that effort, and maybe even to secure a gravitational wave detector in Australia. This is something that the community here would love to see happen. There is also, though, as you mentioned, a gravitational wave detector which is going to go into space eventually, and this is called LISA. It's also an acronym. This is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, if I'm remembering correctly. But it's basically similar to LIGO. It's a laser beam down 2 long arms, but it's much, much bigger. So many, many times longer than LIGO. And by putting it in space, you get away from all the sources of noise that we deal with here on Earth. So one of LIGO's main noise sources is seismic noise. It turns out that the Earth, at every point on the surface of the Earth is shaking all the time. And so if you try to do any precision experiment on the surface of the Earth, that precision is limited by the constant shaking of the Earth, which happens not just from plate tectonics, but things like the lapping of the ocean waves against the beaches around the continents causes permanent shaking everywhere. You can't get rid of it unless you go to space. So you pay a lot of money to fly up there, but then you can really get away from things like seismic noise. So LISA is a complementary experiment to LIGO. It is measuring much lower frequency signals, so these correspond to much bigger, more massive black holes, whereas LIGO sees gravitational waves from black holes formed from stars. LISA will be measuring the supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies or maybe slightly less massive than that, black holes called intermediate mass black holes, but they don't overlap. LIGO is the relatively light black holes, and LISA is the really heavy ones.
Well, thank you, Eric, for joining us on the Space Show.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
And I was speaking with Professor Eric Thrane from Monash School of Physics and Astronomy on Monday. And a little birdie whispered in my ear just a little while ago that there's going to be a big announcement tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. So if you want to listen in to the news, read the newspapers, no doubt you'll hear something about it. I can't tell you what it is now, but around about mid-morning tomorrow, if you go to our website, which is space.southernfm.com.au, that's space.southernfm.com.au, and go to the 2025 programs page and scroll right down to the bottom, I think you might find a little a bit of a story there as well. So don't do it now. It's not there yet. It won't be there until mid-morning tomorrow. Now, let's go on. Thank Professor Thrane for that extended conversation. And we've got Linda Williams back again. And this is to the tune of the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations. And as you've probably realized by now, the whoop sound is of the gravitational waves caused by two colliding black holes. So this is called Gravity Vibrations.
I love the way they radiate from 100 million light years away.
Let's go back to the black hole music by John Barry.
Thank you.
And falling into a black hole. That was John Barry and the London Symphony Orchestra. And that was the music from the movie The Black Hole, which I didn't think much of. Anyway, just time to tell you that you've been listening to The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. So we'll be back next Wednesday with more about black holes and some of the wonderful findings about them. A new announcement to be made tomorrow. I can't tell you what it is now, but stay tuned.